And, well, I'm so very pleased that you've agreed to do this interview. And let's start by you giving me your name, and then you can go on to describe how you got into farming, which is the way you worked in the grain industry.
Well, my name is John Fraze. I started farming back, bought my first quarter in 1947. I was working together with my father at that time, and we shared the implements. In fact, seeding the first couple of years was still done with horses, which became rather difficult if the tractor was working on the same field and you seeding with horses, which I was doing. The horses had to put it in a higher gear.
Which they didn't do very easily, I don't suppose.
No.
So the farming was sort of almost hereditary. Your father had farmed, his father had farmed, and so on, as the Mennonites had done for many, many centuries, probably.
Well, actually, my father was trained as a bookkeeper, but when he came to Canada, that was one of the stipulations that they would be farming. The first couple of years that he was here, he worked for a farmer in Saskatchewan. Then he started farming together with his brother. And third, do you want any dates?
Sure, dates are great.
In 1938, we moved to Manitoba and started farming there.
Where did you move to in Manitoba?
The home place where my son bought that now. It's in the third generation.
I see. So this is the place north of Elm Creek
Northwest of Elm Creek.
Northwest.
Yes.
How close to number, it's 13.
13 Highway, yeah, we're three miles off 13 Highway. Actually, now it's mile 53. And
west of the Prime Meridian.
Yeah, 53 north of the U.S. border and 27 west of the first meridian.
27 west. Yes, I've noticed when driving the highways that the roads are mostly numbered. That's a very nice feature. So you don't have to go back to the, as I do, you know, Southeast Quarter 2194, where I grew up, north of Culdross. Not many miles from where you were farming, actually.
No, that's very true. And it was interesting. A company had owned that farm. A farmer bought the place before, but as the neighbors told us, he spent money on machinery and not paying the payments and eventually lost the farm.
Good grief. That's a very, very serious miscalculation. So you've been in this area then since 1938, and I gathered when I was setting up this interview that you are, in fact, still helping with the farm, if not actually...
Yes, I am still helping my sons. They farm. I actually sold the last quarter to our son the other day, but I still do the cultivating, the harrowing. I'm back where I started. When I first helped on the farm, that's what I could do, is harrow, and that's what I do now and cultivate. But it's quite a difference, a much bigger machine. 2 years ago, when my son put the GPS on the tractor, he gave me a call on the cell and said, "Well, Dad, how's that compared to horses?" Well, I thought I had to get back on him on this one. So I said, "Well, you know, with horses, I came to the end of the field. They knew how to turn around. This thing, I still have to turn around."
Yes, horses had their own GPS operating well, especially knowing where the barn was, I suppose. And so you have, in fact, farmed as an independent farmer. One of the questions is, for whom did you work? Well, you worked for yourself. After a while, you weren't working for the bank any longer, or?
That's true. Yes, we needed the bank. I remember going in the bank once and wanting to borrow money to buy some equipment, and the banker said, "Well, you should buy cattle, not equipment." I told him cattle would die, the equipment wouldn't.
Yeah, the horses eventually died too, for that matter.
Yes.
Was your farming just grain then, or did you have any livestock?
No, my farming was mixed farming, like cattle, hogs, and for a while we also raised capons for meat that we would sell in the fall. I preferred mixed farming. Actually, I should put in a little story here about when I bought the home place from my mother after my father had passed away. The insurance company was after me to buy insurance, and I was not in agreement with that. So finally they said, look, here on your contract it says you have to buy it. So I ended up buying crop insurance that particular year, and then they wrote me a letter. I should explain why I was objecting to farming. Well, I said,
or to the insurance.
To insurance, pardon me. Yes, and well, I had three reasons. One was I was mixed farming, so I had not, as they say, all the eggs in one basket. The other was PFRA was still in operation then, and they operated according to townships. So I had some land spread around. So one particular year I had a poor crop in one area and a good one in the other. With crop insurance at that time, they averaged the whole thing, which I think now has changed, but then it wasn't. And with PFRA, I got payment on the one part and with the other, because it didn't affect the crop on the other area. And the third reason was that very often with the crop insurance, amount of insurance, production would be just over the insurable amount, and that was one of my objections. You have to pay the premium, and you're so near that it, but you still don't qualify, and that was my third objection. Well, after that, they wrote me a letter that I didn't need to get crop insurance anymore, and I don't think I ever did. Of course, nowadays that's quite different with the input cost so much higher that, and if people need an operating loan, they just can't get it unless they have crop insurance. So
sure.
I guess my arguments don't apply for this year, for this season anymore.
So you had good economic arguments to make against the crop insurance at the time.
I thought they were, and they accepted that too. And
well, they certainly are. I can certainly understand the logic. How much land would you have been farming at that time?
Well, at that time I was farming 560 acres.
So
I never became really big as the farmers did.
Section after section, you were near a whole, near 640 acres, but they were, the quarters, I guess, were dispersed into several townships, were they actually?
Yes, they were at one time, and then I had a quarter next to the highway where we lived before I bought the home place.
That's the one I remember from our moving to about, was it 2 or 3 miles away from here?
Well, we were just...
Or was it just across the highway and then a half a mile north? Was it that close, actually?
Yeah, we were just...
A mile over.
A mile over from the highway. And our neighbor, he had bought a quarter north of the home place, so we were always meeting ourselves on the road to go to our respective fields. So we decided at one time this was enough. We'd trade quarters, and we did that. I believe in 74 or somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had all except one quarter right in the same proximity.
Sure. Did you go to land titles then and actually do a transfer of the...
Yes, we did that legally.
Yes.
Because at that time was the capital gains idea was coming up, and so we had to have an assessment on the value of the land at that time.
Sure. Okay.
We did also rent some land for some time. My son bought a half a section, and we were farming that together and for a while.
So that, how large did the operation with your son then and his land, the operation become? You were up towards a section and a half by that time then,
It was more. We rented that half a section, another 240, so we were
Over two sections then.
Yes, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Also farmed together with my son, And that's when we rented that extra land. But that was the days when the banks wouldn't borrow you little money, but they'd borrow you lots. And my son got this idea of bigger was better. And finally we realized we had a part company, because too many fathers just let their sons take over, and many of them lost the place. So I told my son that, hey, I worked too hard for what I have, that if you're going to go under, you're going to not take me with you. So that's, but now things have changed and he's back farming again and seems to enjoy it. And I guess the lesson did him well.
He did in fact leave farming for a little while, did he?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, he was gone for quite a few years.
Right. Well, that is an interesting experience. Well, the questionnaire has a question: what kind of work did you do? And then we get the typical day. So I think this would be a good time to for us to explore further what you were describing. We could talk about maybe what we should do is dispose of the animals. That is to say, you know, consider how you got into that, when you got out of it. And then we can get back to the grain, which is, of course, our interest, the grain you were growing and how that changed and so on. Were you in mixed farming from the very beginning?
Yes. Actually, when we got married, I got a cow from my parents and my wife got a cow from her, and that started in one pig. That's the way we started.
And this was dairy farming, but primarily for your home consumption, or did you sell cream?
Yes, we sold cream. In fact, when we first started, we didn't have electricity, and we cooled our cream in the well, and that was our refrigeration. In 1954, as actually the first year, our place had hydro, and then of course things changed. For a while we did quite a bit of milking. I also used to go to the dairies and buy Holstein calves and put two calves on a cow and then sell them later on, and actually that worked out very well. And farming too, I had a truck and I used to haul some livestock for the neighbors and myself. And at those days, there was many farmers having laying hens, and they would use shavings for bedding. So I would deliver shavings to them, pick them up at the mills in various places in Winnipeg. I know one time my neighbor was along, and he says, "What is it today, John? Calves or shavings?"
The calves would be sold to become dairy cows for others, or were these?
No, these calves would be sold on the market.
Oh, yeah. So these were steers, in many cases.
Well, they would.
Or yearlings, I suppose.
No, they were sold, actually, I would feed them maybe till they were about 300 pounds, and that was, at that time, a real demand for those kind of calves. And that worked well for a good number of years, but then later on too, the dairies were fewer, so there was less calves available, and we also quit milking cows, so we just changed over to beef cattle.
Yes. So having cows to milk is an incredible pressure on your life. You've got to milk the morning and evening. It really ties you to the farm.
Yes, it does. It's kind of disrupts your day, but the last whiles that we were living on the farm, we had a cow that we would milk in the evening, and then we'd leave the calf out with her, so the calf took care of the milking during the day and evening, and then in the evening we'd put the calf in the pen, so our day was not disrupted.
Right, just the one milking in the evening then.
Yeah, yes. one milking in the morning.
She got the day's milk.
Yeah.
And the raising of the chickens, did you sell eggs at all? Or?
No, we did not. Actually, I was turned off on laying hens. When I was young, before I started on my own, I worked for a farmer, and they also had the laying hens, and that was kind of a sacred flock. You didn't get, very seldom got eggs at the mealtime. At that time, you lived at the place you worked, and so And then when it was a wet day, well, we had to clean the hen house, and so I was turned off on laying hens.
Cleaning a hen house is no fun, especially if it's after a full winter. I won't get into a story or two I could tell from my own farm about chicken houses. The capons, of course, were a matter of you bought the chicks and raised them to a particular weight again,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah, that used to be quite a good income from that business. There was quite a demand for it, and once your name, people were aware of it, you would have more orders than you had supply.
This was in the area that you weren't selling to industry, or?
No, we didn't sell to industry.
We'll just carry on farming across the next lot, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, that's my neighbor. He's always mowing our lawn.
Should
I ask him to?
Okay, well, let's get back to, we were just talking about the selling of those chickens, and I was wondering whether you were selling sort of privately. It wasn't that you were supplying a slaughterhouse or anything.
No, like that's there. Right. We were selling on private customers in the neighborhood, and we had quite a few actually in Winnipeg, seeing we have relatives there, that word kind of got around.
Sure, the good chickens were coming in today. And of course, the connection of all of these animals to the farm operation, this project is interested in the grain trade, these animals were consuming some of what you were growing in the way of the feed that you fed them, I suppose.
Yes, definitely. That was also consumed quite a bit of grain, and when we had hogs, well, which consumed more. At that time, there's not too many would get their ready-mixed feed brought in, but we do the mixing ourselves, so that eliminated some of the grain off the market.
Right. That's an interesting point, actually. One of the arguments against the continuation of the crow rate, and there was a great debate in the early 80s on that, of course, and gradually the arrangements did change. One of the arguments was that the value of the grain might increase on the prairies, and more of it would be used for such things as feeding. But you were doing this, I guess, through the 1970s or even earlier?
Yes, we started in 1950, and we left the farm in 1988, so...
And when would you have moved away from the hogs and the capons and so on?
Well, hogs and capons we quit earlier, probably in the mid-70s. The cattle we kept right to the end. In fact, we still had some when we lived in town. Sure. But then that too, we got rid of them the first year. That was 1988.
Oh, yes. My father spoke of the hogs as mortgage raisers. I guess they produced the annual payment on the mortgage through the 50s. Did you see pigs in a somewhat similar way, raise them for market?
Yes, it was a good source of income, and it spread your income around over the year. Grain trade was a little different then, especially the delivery system on the quota system. I recall in the 50s, early 50s, when the movement was rather slow, and we lived near town, we could see the freight train coming in. And what would happen, neighbors that see it, you'd all run to your truck and load a load of grain and line up in the elevator. And if you weren't there in time, and if the agent only got one box car, well, some of them had to go back with their load of grain. Now the system is much better that way. They contract it out, and they only call you in when your contract is due or they have room.
So the system has changed that dramatically. Farming from the late 40s through for about 40 years, I guess, 47, 88, did you say? So that's a period of time that has encompassed quite a bit of change in the industry, too, for that matter.
Yes, there was quite a bit of change, and of course the time when the Canadian Wheat Board came in at the beginning, you could choose whether you wanted to sell through the wheat board or on the open market. If you didn't have to sell in fall, sometimes it was better to sell, to keep it and go on the open market. But for my situation, usually needed money in the fall. Mortgage payments, land payments came due, payments on implements. So the wheat board actually was for my operation a very helpful situation, that at least you figured you got a fair price for your product.
So you've been a supporter of the wheat board all the way through?
Yes, I have been a supporter. I know nowadays too, that's quite a topic of controversy, and reading the papers, and even the other day in the post office lobby, there was a bunch of farmers together, and one said, well, we're discussing the wheat board, and one fellow who I knew was absolutely opposed to it, he just left in a big hurry.
In that crowd, he wasn't going to be have any sympathizers.
No.
The farming operation that you carried on was growing what kinds of grain?
Well, basically I grew three kinds of cereal: wheat, barley, and oats. Seeing we had livestock for the hogs, barley was a good source of feed for them, and then of course for cattle, oats was, and wheat, and also flax. We did have some peas for a number of years, which were okay for a while, but peas are rather delicate for moisture. They don't handle too much. So eventually, and the market seemed to dry up. I know when my father farmed in those years, the 40s, I remember one year he had 80 acres of sweet clover. It yielded 1,000 pounds to an acre and 10 cents a pound. That's the year he finished making his payments on the farm, and it was a good year. But nowadays, you very, very seldom see sweet clover. And farming has also very changed very much since fertilizer came in. Those days when I farmed, well, towards the end, we did use fertilizer, probably only started in the late 60s, but till then you would, in the heavy land, you would summer fallow 1/3 of the acreage, so in order to get a better production. But now with fertilizer, you don't see any summer fallow, or very, very rarely.
Right. Well, we can talk about the kind of farming that goes on these days a little later.
Oh.
Let's explore that. So you had a three-crop rotation, basically. The summer fallow, then wheat, I suppose, the next year, was it?
Yes.
And then oats and barley, or perhaps flax, the
yes.
second year, for any particular field?
Yes, that was the rotation. On summer fallow, you would seed wheat, and then second crop, barley or oats or flax, and some people were in a rotation of three crops and then summer fallow. My father usually operated that way. His land wasn't quite as heavy, and that worked quite well.
For a four-year rotation,
yeah,
then, wasn't
yeah,
it? Right.
That's right, a four-year rotation.
So, of course, having lived in the area, I'm aware of light land and heavy land, and yours was all part of that continuation of, I guess it's somewhere between the Red River and Assiniboine Rivers, that quite heavy land that we have north of Elm Creek, but northwest there's also the sandier land, the lighter land.
Yes, that's true, and the home place on southwest of 3495 was just east of the ridge. There's a ridge that goes from Elm Creek at an angle to the northwest, and on the west side of the ridge, the land is much lighter, and on the east side, it gets heavier as you get further away from the ridge.
And your farming was all on that heavier land.
Yes, well, we had some that was a bit lighter on the west side of 34, but it was not considered,
considered real light land. No. Well, we won't get into, unless we want to talk about later, about what could happen on either side of that sand ridge. But so you were raising these grades then on a three-year rotation, basically. And only in the 60s did you become involved in using fertilizers at all. I suppose you were spraying for weeds from early on.
Yes, well, the sprayer came in. I think the first sprayer we had was in 1949. Actually, I had a small tractor, and then the idea was you didn't want much tracks on the grain field. So my neighbor bought the sprayer, and we put it on my tractor, and we had an 80-gallon tank at the back of the tractor, and I would spray his land and ours and my father's, and then because I was doing the spraying, I could do some custom work. I remember spraying with a 32-foot sprayer for 35 cents an acre. One of the neighbors I sprayed for, it took me about 6 years before I got paid, but other than that, the rest were all very good customers. And spraying at first, all we sprayed for was mustard. And the talk then was, well, once we get chemical that we can spray wild oats, that'll be the end of all that. Well, it's 2010 now, and people are still spraying for wild oats, and I guess that'll never cease.
never really kill them. I guess broadleaf and narrowleaf weeds are a consideration. Mustard would be a broader leaf and easier to kill, I guess. What were you spraying with? What was the chemical?
Oh, MCP, MCPA was come in then, and 2,4-D.
I want to say 2,4-D in the 50s, because it seems to me that's what Dad was then, using as well.
I know at first the weeds were really easy to kill, but seemingly over the years, as though they built up resistance, so we'd have to spray a little heavier. But it really paid off. I know one year I made one round around the field, and, well, I thought it was not worth spraying. There weren't enough weeds, so I just left it. Well, later on, the weeds came up, and on the other stuff that I hadn't sprayed, but the flax was too far advanced, I couldn't spray because of that. And for years, I could tell the difference. That one round that I made with a sprayer was much cleaner than the rest of the field.
Nothing like test plots on a paying field, I'm sure, to teach the lesson. We didn't worry very much in the 50s about how we did this, face masks or whatever, or did you ever worry about spraying? You'd avoid spraying, you know, on a windy day, because of course it would, or did you? What do you want to say about
it? Well, the effect, the farm yards were much closer, and you did have to respect your neighbors and your neighbor's garden. I know I was once blamed I had sprayed too close and the neighbor's garden was affected, and I'm not sure. I didn't think it was, but I remember we did have to watch out for wind. If the wind was too high, you could not spray, especially if there was a crop next to you that was peas or something like that, which couldn't handle any spray.
No. Did you ever worry about the chemicals' effect on yourself?
No, we never. There never was much warning about it, the effect of the chemicals, and I don't know if first years I ever wore gloves handling it. But
During the first years you did, or later on?
Well, later on we used gloves and were more careful, and even used masks sometimes. And the important thing was not to spray when the wind was up at all.
It killed weeds, not people.
That's right.
So, fertilizer, chemicals, that would be the main inputs into your farming operations. The kind of cultivation that you carried out, that will have changed over time, I suppose. The
yes.
kind of machinery even that you used.
That's very true. At first we used to plow, do the fall plowing of all the stubble except what went into summer fallow the next year, and usually you plow that in spring. But eventually with better cultivators made, and that would also keep the stubble and straw above and prevent from soil drifting, which was implemented. And of course nowadays that's a big thing, and now the equipment is so much better. They got these heavy harrows that now we harrow all the stubble before we cultivate to break up the straw, and that does a very good job. And you burning is very seldom done, if ever, although there are still people that drop their swath behind the combine, the straw, don't spread it, and then burn the swath. But that's a tedious job and also very risky, that you burn the whole field, and that's definitely not good.
I suppose where the fire is really hot, it can almost burn into the humus of the soil, can it?
Yes, it
make the soil.
I never liked burning, and now with the equipment that you have, the straw choppers, which is a big advantage, that chops up the straw and spreads it better. Yes. And there are in our area, and when I was farming with cattle, you baled a lot of straw.
Yeah.
You need it for bedding, and barley straw or oat straw was also a supplement for feed for the livestock, which was another reason that I liked the mixed farming. And we had dairy farmers in the neighborhood who had very little land. They would bale straw on our land. So straw wasn't, as a rule, a problem, an odd exception.
No. It is interesting how things have changed. Growing up on a farm, leaving it in a way in 1960, and go off to university and so on. But I remember in the 50s how much burning of straw there was. In the harvest season, in the evening, you'd see fires in every direction sometimes as farmers were burning. But even then, it was not a good idea to do it, really, if one wants to restore the life to the soil.
Yes.
Put the record on again. You mentioned plowing initially, and this was honest-to-goodness plowing. Was it a three-share plow or whatever behind the tractor, and you were actually turning the soil over after the harvest, were you?
Yes, yes, it was. We had a three-bottom plow, and I know the first quarter I bought in 1947, it hadn't been looked after too well, so I plowed the whole quarter. It took me quite a while.
I can imagine.
And that year I only sowed 50 acres of oats, and the other 105 or so, there was a little bush on that place.
Oh, yeah.
I summer fallowed. I remember harvesting my first crop of oats. Got about 30 bushels to an acre, I believe. Anyway, I hauled the oats out and made a down payment on my taxes of $50, and made my land payment, and then went to work in winter to be able to start farming next spring.
Earned that working capital by, what did you work at over the winter?
Well, that particular winter I went to BC to work. The following winter I went to the mines. I had been in the mines earlier, and then I went back to the coal mine to be able to keep on farming.
Were you in the bush in BC the first year?
No, I went to the West Coast and I got a job at a dairy farmer.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, my job was to deliver the manure. He was a big dairy farmer, and I went with a truck full of manure all over Vancouver to the various gardeners. Quite an experience, and they had many toll bridges there then, and when I'd come up there, they'd hold their nose and tell me how much to pay and get out of here.
And then you worked in the coal mines as well. I mean, that wasn't very common for farmers from here to end up in the coal mines in the winter, was it?
No, it wasn't, but during the war years, and there was an agreement if you went to the coal mine in winter, you could spend the summer on the farms to.
So some of this then was before you were married, when you were a young man that you were doing
Yes,
this.
yes,
Yeah.
yes. All this working out was before I was married, and I did help or work for the neighbors after I got married, but not away from home.
No, I see.
I also supplement my farming. At those times, there were a lot of small farmers who didn't have a grain truck, so I would be hauling grain for them to town.
Sure.
I didn't make big money, but kept food on the table and the
Every
wolf from the door.
dollar counts,
Yeah.
and especially good in those days.
Yeah, back to the input costs in farming. Fuel at that time was not a big expense. The biggest expense was your chemical, and then of course when fertilizer came in, but it also paid off very well.
You found out you did it because it did pay.
Yes.
Wouldn't have done it, I'm sure, if it didn't. When would you first have used discers to replace the plow? Because I'm assuming that's what happened. You also
Yes,
used
well, the diskers came in the early 30s, pardon me, in the early 50s. Before that, they had the one-way disk, but it was a bigger machine or a heavier machine with bigger disks. It didn't work too well. You couldn't do a good job, but when the diskers came in, that was really a lifesaver for many, many people.
Would there have been different sizes of one-way discs, one-way
Oh,
diskers,
yeah.
the first generation? Because it seems to me that my father had one with discs that, I'm trying to remember, would they have been maybe 15 inches or something like that?
Well,
So they weren't that large, and it.
the diskers had about 15, 16 inches of their size of discs, but the one-way disc, which we used to call, which
Yeah, well, that's what
some,
I'm thinking of.
oh yeah, they were about 8 feet, but their discs were at least 20 inches, 22 inches, and
Ooh.
with that circumference in the clay, you couldn't either go very deep or not sh
Right.
too. That would be too deep for seeding. So the diskers, when they came in, that was great
Sure.
help, and it speeded up the farming too.
Yes.
One of the problems the farmers had to remember, you don't always go around the field the same way. You throw it back, or else you get a ridge around the edge of the field, and
Yes, I remember that fine point to be sure they kept the field more or less level.
yeah.
You have to be very careful. In fact, I guess you sometimes they disc the other way around.
Yes, and especially people that disked in fall as well, they often started in the center of the field and then threw it back in, which kept the field much more on the level.
Right.
Another thing of really significance was in the farming change was when the changed from power lift to hydraulic, which was a great invention.
Yes.
And it really helped you control the depth of your machine much better.
Right. Did the diskers become hydraulic then as well?
Yeah, the diskers,
Because cultivators certainly did as well, didn't they?
the one-way disks, when they came out, they were power lift, which you pull a rope and there's a mechanism in one of the wheels that locks it then and lifts the machine up.
Oh, yes.
One of those things was too, if you'd get into a wet spot with power lift and you didn't pull that rope soon enough, the wheel wouldn't have traction, it would just skid, so you couldn't raise it. You were really in trouble then. With a power lift, well, you could do that anytime and it works very well.
Yeah, these are really fine points of cultivating fields. The deep tillage cultivator came along at some point in the 1950s as well. Did you have one?
Yes, that was the big thing, and at that time they were emphasizing you really had to work your land fairly deep in fall. I guess the assumption before when plowing you turned it over completely, and now to do that, over the years that has changed too, that there isn't that great necessity of going that deep, although it does help if you get too wet a year that it absorbs more moisture if you worked a little deeper.
Right. My father actually built a deep tillage cultivator because he didn't have the money to buy one outright, and so he welded up he'd begun welding in the 50s, so he welded up the channel ironed to make the main units. I think bought the wheels and so on and so forth. No. He had to buy the shanks and shovels, of course, yeah. The actual business of it. But he ended up with his own deep tillage cultivator at some point, I think, around 1955, 56. Does that sound about right? It seems to me it was in there that he
did this. Yes, that's right. And
but you're suggesting that that ended up being phased out then after?
Are not used nearly as much. The cultivators now have their shanks closer together and do not go as deep, but do still make a very good job. Actually, one of the earliest deep tillers was the Graham Home Plow, which they called, and it didn't have power lift or hydraulic at first, so it was by levers. I know my neighbor had one, and he'd work around the field. He'd had a marker made on it, so he drove straight. Of course, that has changed too with GPS now. You drive straight, and it's also a good advantage for spraying. Very often it's too windy during the day to spray, but with GPS you can spray at night, and it's a great invention.
Well, I noticed some, and I guess it's this power harrowing, as I'm tempted to call it, that you were describing, fields that had been harrowed, I guess it's diagonally to the road. You glanced at them and you're true as a die, row after row. And so that's the GPS that keeps you on track, Doug.
Yes, that's, you can always tell going down the road if the people have used GPS, and it's a great invention. I know my boys, I used to tell them, we had a neighbor, Ernie Schrein, he drove very straight without GPS, and just recently one of my sons said, well, Dad always told us to drive straight like Ernie. He says, now we can.
Well, I well remember the temptation was always to check your straightness by glancing back, and that always produced the squiggle because the whole body would move couldn't turn just your head, and of course you'd turn the wheel a little bit and so on.
Yes.
But of course the way to avoid this embarrassment is not to do it straight to the road, or to the main road. You usually have to do it to some road or other, but choose your road from which you work.
Yes, there's a story about when we were doing plowing and making a strikeout. You'd have a mark at the other end of the field and one beyond that, and this fella, he couldn't tell very well what that mark was, and here it was a fella moving with a load of hay, and that really changed his course.
Yes, I can well imagine. Yes, indeed. What a lie that would be. So in terms of the inputs, we've explored those and the kind of machinery. The seed drills used to be used initially for the seeding, and then the discers could also be used for seeding, couldn't they? And I guess equipment is, well, maybe you should say a word or two about those, and then whatever developed after that.
Oh, okay, yes, the seed drills, and then there was also a press drill which had packers behind the wheel behind the seed drill. They were used very often in the lighter land, the press drills, which was very effective. Also, if it was more on the dry side, this was compact the seed in the earth, and it would germinate faster. Usually in the heavy land, we just use the natural double disc seed drills. Then the discers came in for seeding, and of course, any change, there's some always reluctant. But what it did do, you would work the field, kill the weeds, and seed at the same time. With a seed drill, you would usually cultivate your field before and then seed it, and this would, especially in the heavy clay, would be a bit more lumpy and would also dry out faster. So the discers were really a very good invention. Now, in our area, you seldom see one, if ever. Now it's the seed drill or the air drill, air seeder or the air drill. The air seeder is a cultivator with narrow shanks and injects the seed behind the shank, and the air drill is actually the same machine, only it has packers behind the cultivator shanks, which is a big thing. Another great advantage is with the air seeder or air drill, they have tanks at the back which are driven with a blower that inject the blow the seed and the fertilizer into the pipes behind the, or the hoses I should say, behind the shanks, and it has a bigger capacity of your seed grain as well as your fertilizer. There are two compartments, and you adjust just the amount you put on an acre, and you can seed quite a number of acres with one filling, which speeds up the whole process very much. With the discers especially, their fertilizer boxes usually were rather small, and you'd have to stop so often to fill them up to keep going, and the air seeder and air drill have really sped that process up by a very high percentage.
Right. The discers were often quite a fair length, too. You'd go from a seed drill that might be, what would it be, 20?
Well, the seed drills were usually 14 feet. There were some larger ones. A 14-foot drill was a 28 run. They had a disc every 6 inches. And the discers were, they came out, the first ones came out 12 feet, but then they were 15s and then 16s, and very often two or three hookups of discers. When your tractors got larger tractors, and you'd have the tandem hookup. One of the problem at first was when you would move, it was a little bit of a chore, but later on they improved the whole hitching mechanism. As soon as it was lifted out the ground, they would narrow a position and trail each other fairly well. So that was another big advantage and a promotion for farmers to get bigger and fewer.
I dare say, yes, these things all go together. And the size of the tractors, of course, begins to change too. They were more or less the same kind of tractors into what, the 1960s, and then those huge, sometimes eight wheels, four dual wheels and whatnot, or large tires began to appear.
Yes, they're, that's what you see now, four wheelers, dual wheels, and even there are those that have triple wheels, which makes makes 12 tires on a machine. So if you got a tire going or a couple of tires going, you make sure you got some money in the bank to pay for that.
Yeah, I won't hesitate to ask how much they cost each, but it'd be a pretty fair price on them.
Yes, all those prices of parts have increased so very much that I know, checking my record book at the first year I farmed, you would buy some parts for cents. You wouldn't even pay a dollar. Well, now that's quite a different story. So yeah. With all that mechanization, the cost has improved. So farmers do need more land to make it a viable operation.
The multi-tire tractors are designed, are they deliberately designed to reduce the weight of the machine on the land to compress the soil
less?
Yes,
that is very true. They spread the weight over a large area. And as I mentioned before, that when we started spraying, I had this little tractor, which was really good. In fact, I sowed some wheat for my neighbor with it, and he was so impressed that I left hardly any tracks behind from the seed drill. So, and now you will see people spraying with dual wheel tractors, but the flotation is spread over the weight, that after a couple of days you do not see that the sprayer has gone there. Wow. Actually, now with the high boy sprayers, you see the tracks much more than you do if people spray with a pull type and a dual wheel tractor.
Because these sprayers have fairly narrow tires. I guess the question is whether to crush more grain or to compact less soil.
Yes, that's there's two different size of tires. I guess most of these high boys have one. The narrow one is also because of row crop, because a lot of row crop is sprayed, because there's so much chemical now, and even in row crop they do not necessarily cultivate, but they spray the fields, so they use the narrow tire. Another new invention is now with this, what they call pre-harvest Roundup. If you have quack grass or green weeds in your crop, and you spray it after your grain is ripe, and then, or more or less ripe, you spray the weeds and wait 6 days or so, and then you can often go in straight combine. So that is another change over the years. Years ago, we never, or very seldom, did any straight combining.
I see.
But nowadays, that is done quite a bit.
The intention then is to kill anything that might be in there other than the grain, which is already ripe, or pretty well ripe, and then you can straight combine.
Personally, I have a little difficulty with this pre-harvest Roundup. I know scientifically it has been proven that it has no effect on the value or the food, no residue for food. And yet the seed growers do not want pre-harvest Roundup grain for seed. So in my little mind, I have a little difficulty not questioning whether it really does affect a residue. But that's a personal opinion.
Well, it is indeed. And from my own teaching in environmental history, I would incline to caution. They call it the precautionary principle. Hasn't been proven, but there is probably reason to be suspicious. And until you can be absolutely certain, don't do something. And so you're actually following the precautionary principle, I think, on this matter.
Yes, and I tell my boys I'm not so sure about this pre-harvest Roundup. Oh, it does great. We kill the quack and we kill any other weeds, and you have a clean crop.
Yes. Matters of opinion, and maybe a bit more. The harvesting machinery, of course, is the other thing, from binders and sheaves and stooks. We actually saw some driving through the Pembina somewhere or other, coming back from Deloraine a couple of days ago.
There. Oh, yeah.
Lovely to see some stook grain standing there, but of course combines have been the basis for years, and whether they were tractor-drawn or self-propelled combines, and they got bigger and bigger, too, I guess. And I happened to see one this morning with rubber Caterpillar tracks on the front wheels and the other wheels behind that, which I think that was something novel, this particular John Deere combine I saw rolling along the highway.
Yes, very true. Like in this area this year, we've had a lot of rain, and also it's sporadic, like not the same in every area, but tracks on the combine, they can do the job where even the self-propelled swather cannot go. And of course the combines nowadays are much bigger, and rotary combines, which are less moving parts and work much better, as they tell us. And over the years, I ask myself, with all the change that has come about, how much more can there be? But who knows, in this world of technology, how much more there is to improve on.
The combines were, I suppose, in terms of the works, however they were moved along the field, whether they had their own locomotion, the engines and so on and so forth or not, but I guess it was probably basically the rotary drums that did the threshing of the grain. But that was rotary too, but when you refer to a rotary combine now, that's a different kind of rotary, I guess.
Yeah, the rotary combines, they do not have straw walkers. It goes through the rotor and then it kind of a drum where it the straw turns around and the grain falls to the bottom. That is like less moving parts, no straw walkers.
You should say a bit more. When you said straw walkers, I sort of remembered what was inside the guts of a combine, but probably you should describe what you're referring to.
Oh, well, the straw walkers were about 6 to 8 inches wide, and they were side by side on a crankshaft that they would not be in the same position to shake the straw out. And it picked the grain that had went through the cylinder, come onto the straw walker with a beater, and then it would be shake it down, and they were on a slope underneath, they were porous, and underneath was a shield that would let the grain fall on it, and then it would convey the grain to the front of the machine again to land on the chaffer, and through the chaffer it would go on to the bottom sieve, and what went over the bottom sieve would go through the return elevator that would bring that part, that amount of grain through the cylinder again, and what went through the bottom sieve would go into the elevator that would deliver it into the hopper.
Well, that's a very good description of the workings of a combine, actually, and it makes one appreciate the ingenuity, the thought and the skill that went into designing a combine which would do the threshing while the machine rolled along through the field with the grain coming in at the front across the pickup if it had been swathed by a separate machine, or as you were saying, with the cutting blades cutting the grain so that it fell, the windrows pulling it in and dropping it in to go through the grain, or through the combine rather, for this threshing process. And it has to be dry, of course, to do that.
Yes, or at least near dry, and that is another thing of harvesting, and which was quite a change from the thrashing machines. In the thrashing machine, you had your grain in stooks, which would not attract the dew nearly as much, or you'd leave a few racks loaded in the evening, and you could start earlier. Now with a combine, and that was quite an adjustment at first to wait till the dew is off, because that just didn't work. So it changed the day of operation from late in the morning or near noon to, and if there wasn't a dew on in the evening, you would be able to combine very late. Even sometimes you could combine through the night, which was quite a change from the thrash machine.
Yeah, the lights on and the machine moving through the night out there picking up the grain.
Yes, actually it's quite a sight now with the machines and all the lights they have on, or some of them, you'd think there was some kind of a castle moving along the field.
Yeah,
the other thing, a great change is in hauling the grain. Of course, the machines are bigger, so they process much grain much faster, and what they call a grain cart now that is usually on two big wheels and a tractor that'll go alongside the combine, and they unload the hopper as they go, and which grain cart is a great advantage because it handles the wet conditions much better, and it's also easier on the trucks. You have the trucks at the end of the field, and this grain cart has a large unloading auger, so within a couple of minutes it'll unload 500 to 900 bushels wow. in a couple of minutes. So it really speeds up the harvest, and of course then we have the municipality to contend with. We with larger loads, we do more damage to the roads.
That part of the of the farming activity and its consequences always existed, of course. The roads had to be built up or graveled in areas where the soil was sticky when it got wet. But I guess over time, municipal councils become anxious about the size of stuff out there, eh? Because it...
Yes, that is true. And years ago, with the clay roads, if it rained, you just stayed home. But now they have access to a gravel road. Each farm site has an actual access to a gravel road. Not necessarily all roads are gravel. Some of them you can only navigate when it's dry, but you can get out to town or wherever on a gravel road. Not necessarily always the shortest road, but it's the safest road. Mm-hmm. And over the years too, they are improving the roads, maintaining them more often, and of course there still are restrictions on in some areas. And
you're describing Gray Municipality particularly here.
Yes.
The policy has been to gravel to every farmer then, from say every farmer gets along Highway 13, for example, or some distance in, will get gravel to his yard then, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it will not necessarily be straight out, but and then also the other thing, they keep gravel on the bus routes. So wherever the bus travels, that's those roads are graveled.
Yes. And not just to the councillor's yard. No. I'm not sure that ever happened, and I better not name any names, but I'm thinking of the possibility that a councillor's yard got gravel faster than others did.
Well, that's a good point, Ernie. Sometimes a councillor will only run for one term of office, and it's surprising how much good work is done in a particular area, and probably it was overdue, and maybe sometimes that's the way to get it done. A problem with Gray that I see now is all the trees that are growing in the ditches. And that's getting to be quite a issue. When I think back years in the 40s, every farmer had a few animals, so all the ditches were mowed and they made hay, yeah. And that was a source of feed. Now they don't have it, so the ditches, they do get mowed by the RM, but not all the way, just from the top side. So sure. We have quite a few trees in some areas. It's actually almost like a shelter belt down the ditch.
Yes. Now that's, would you want to say anything about the draining of land that was required in order to farm?
Well, that drainage is another issue. I remember very well, just after the war, at the meeting about drainage, a professor was out and he told us something, and I still remember that. He said, be careful when you disrupt a natural drain. And over the years in our municipality too, and he mentioned that, we've built roads and built them very quickly and very economically with the elevating grader. But the elevating grader follows the contour of the land, and with that there are times you disrupt the drainage, and if once you do that, you got to be careful to have an outlet. And with all the drainage that is done drainage work, each farmer wants to get rid of his water as quick as can, but we all know it goes east of here, and more and more water comes from the west, and going east it just can handle so much. Now, technically, or it is usually figured out by the book how much it will handle, but when you have a spring with a lot of growth in the ditches, that slows the drainage down again, which creates problem. And yeah. Another thing about disrupting a natural drain, I know up in our area they've done that, and they've let it through some light land, and it just raises havoc if there's a very heavy sudden rain. I think this gentleman that warned us about that really had a good point, and too often...
You don't remember his name by any chance. Sounds interesting. Who was responsible? Is it the RM that is entirely responsible for these ditches now, or is there any provincial authority that comes in?
No,
on
there, there's certain ditches that are the responsibility of the provincial government. Others are of the municipality, and I'm not sure. I would not be able to say which one is which.
So as an individual farmer, you were aware that this work was going on, but it didn't actually touch you directly other than hearing this particular professor's some wise thoughts.
Yes, and over the years, there has been a lot done, but like in this last year where we had so much rain, in fact, I spoke to a farmer the other day, and he had an area where he farmed 700 acres, and he said he probably had about 100 acres of crop. Now,
really?
That's east and southeast of here where, and I've gone through there, there's surprising how many fields are drowned out, but you get more and more water coming in, and it only takes so much that is let out to the La Salle River, and it ends up in the Red or Assiniboine, and you know they only handle so much, so it comes in faster, but the closer it gets to the outlet, the longer it's held back.
Yeah. Let me say, just describe two or three things that I've noticed over the last 10 years or a little bit more and get your reaction to them. I used to map the area, you know, the telephone books had the home yard by the quarter and so on and so forth, and if you knew the area, you know where exactly in the quarter it was. So I did that sort of thing, and one day about 10 years ago I was looking at the rural telephone book for this area, and was surprised to find that on the heavy land, this was perhaps even more true south of number 2 highway towards Homewood, there seemed to be a lot fewer yards across on the heavy land than there were west of the ridge into the sandy land. And I thought that was very curious, that the land that I'd always thought of as poorer land for farming, you probably share the prejudice, was the place where people seemed to be living.
Well, that is true. And with fertilizer coming in, this lighter land really produces, it's very productive for corn. And there are a number of places people are living and not necessarily making their living off the farm. They're working out. Now, that is also a good improvement. Years ago, they could live there and pay hardly any taxes because it was only the acreage that was taxed. But since a number of years, and that is quite a few years ago already, that has changed where they assess the buildings. And I have argument with these people, you know, they say, oh, now we got to pay taxes. Well, I says, you only have a few acres and you pay that little amount of tax, but you have the benefit of all the roads and the school system and everything. So I think it's a fair assessment that our buildings are assessed. Now, I'm sure some people will say that's not so, but you got to look over the whole picture. And that makes really sense, because they have the benefit of having a small acreage, having a rural residence, and make living in this area. There's quite a few people that drive to the city every day for work.
To Winnipeg.
Nice.
So there's bedroom suburbs, if you will, as far out as Elk Creek.
And there are others that work in Portage la Prairie or even to the south type of thing. So I think that was a big improvement. And
I suppose the other half of it is the way in which farms have become large, so that one person may farm one, two, three sections or whatever. And so there's one yard for all of that land, where there used to be perhaps a yard on every half section or even more.
Yes, very true, because the farms are so much larger, the acreage that they work, and with the equipment that they have, you can move from one place to the other. My son, he farms around 1,500 acres. Well, he farms his father-in-law's and his father's and rents a bunch of us land beside.
Sure.
And there's a spread of 14 miles between the places. But with the equipment you have, can move quite easily.
There was a time when I was growing up, half a century ago, when the family that had that kind of acreage, I guess, were the McIntyres, north of Elm Creek and Culross. But there was the father, or the parents, and then the four boys, and there were four, even five yards, I suppose, that went with that land. So it didn't have,
yes,
appear the same way.
Yes, that's true. And even you have farmers now that live in the village and farm quite a bit of land. Another thing is west of the ridge we have a number of dairy farmers, large dairy farmers, and they buy up a lot of that land so to produce feed for their animals, and also a disposal of the manure. They have to have a certain amount, because there's regulations, and which are good, that you have to have a certain amount of acreage if you have a certain amount of animals, which is good. But this also increases them to have more productivity.
Sure. The what was I going to ask? The dairy farming then, this would involve corn, I suppose. It's cut a silage, is it? In many cases,
corn is a silage. They also, there's a number of them. They have a alfalfa and silage, and they also buy a quarter of oats and cut that in silage if they haven't got enough. And they really have a sophisticated setup with three different silos with three different types of feed in there, and it's all computerized. You press this button and that button, and it augers it into a conveyor, into a feed hopper, and from that feed hopper it goes into your feed tank, which you then deliver to your animals. It's quite a sight to see. In fact, some of the dairy farmers, they have robot milkers. They're visiting in town, and their robot is milking, but he has a mechanism on him that beeps to him if there's something goes wrong. So,
and he runs back out to the farm to see what's gone wrong, I suppose.
Yeah. it's quite the life.
Yes, indeed. The other change, there may be still other changes we can talk about, but one of the most obvious changes to anyone driving through Manitoba or across the prairies is the way in which the grain handling has changed from all of those line elevators. Every town, every village, Culross had the two elevators until into the 60s, I guess, anyway. And then you could tell me how that changed and what its impact was.
Well, that is a very, very big change. And it affects different areas of the agriculture. For one thing, now the farmers have to have larger trucks to deliver the grain, because it's further to go. It's really sophisticated. Like here, to get your grain sampled, used to be you have to take a sample as you dump. Well, now they have a vacuum that you unroll your tarp and you drive in this place, and they put a probe down a couple of places in your box, and by the time you get into the elevator, they've got this sample there and assess the grade and the dockage and everything. So the whole process of and moving of it is really speeded up. The other thing is with the larger grain elevators, fast throughput as they call them, they have more tracks so they can load more cars at a time, and a longer track so they can handle as much as 100 cars on their site that they can put through the elevator. And this is another thing that I know when here in Elm Creek we still had a small elevator and the big one, and the big elevator would get the hopper cars, and at that time we still had box cars. The small elevator would get the box cars, which is harder to load and more inconvenient. You got to close up the doors and board up the doors and all that type of stuff. So that whole thing has changed now. I remember once being in the elevator here, and he got a call, and he said, the elevator says, I don't make mind taking my role, but when I see you sorting out the hopper cars and sending it to the big elevator and taking the box cars and giving it to me, that's enough.
Yeah. Whose was the small? Was it the Manitoba Pool, the
elevator here? Manitoba Pool was the... No, it was Patterson, actually. We had two small ones operating.
Okay. So there was a Patterson elevator in town here as well.
Well, there were three at one time, Ogilvy, Patterson, and Pool Elevator.
Yes.
Now we have Cargill, and the Pool Elevator is there. The building is there, but two farmers have bought it, and they use it as storage. This is another thing that has happened over the years. I know one farmer just north of here, he bought the elevator in Oakville. And this really puzzles me of the transportation of grain. I know years ago we lived halfway between Elm Creek and Oakville. Oakville would get the cars and Elm Creek wouldn't, so we'd be hauling to Oakville. Now they haven't even got an elevator, and it's on a double line.
There certainly could be, but big companies have certainly made their decisions. The Cargill throughput here was one of the first in southern Manitoba, was it?
Yes, it was, and it's doing a good job, but it's surprising how far people haul grain. Yeah. I have a relative, he lives in north of Brandon, and he hauls to Carmen. You know,
To Carmen.
Now, I think that's a special crop, possibly peas.
Oh,
but
yeah. Wow.
And this is another thing, it's really hard on the highways with all the trucks. I noticed this year a lot of the semis, without the trailers, like the semis, they have put the third axle on the back wheel to be able to handle that better and
distribute the weight a little better.
Yes, distribute the weight.
Yes. Yes, these two trailer semis are quite the thing. I remember photographing one in Saskatchewan a few years ago, and I think that same symbol on the side of the trailer is one I've been seeing along. In fact, I passed, I think, a couple of them coming out of number 2 highway from Winnipeg. This morning, so.
Yes.
Do you know what company, is that one company that has the?
No, not necessarily. There's a number of them that have, they call the B train, and then there's the Super B, which takes a little more. Another thing, a lot of the farmers have a.
Something like having a train coming through town when we're talking about grain.
Yes.
right sound.
And really, this train only goes to Rathwell, which has a large... you got it off now?
No.
Large terminal there, and that's about as far as it goes. And you will see them take the empty cars there, and if they haven't got full cars to pick up, you'll see the locomotive go to Winnipeg and come back just empty to pick up the cars when they're full.
I see.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
It's one of those harsh realities in the grain trade that there isn't much business for hopper cars coming back. So I guess like the unit trains carrying coal from the Rocky Mountains to Roberts Bank in south of Vancouver. I guess it's a load down, empties back, load down, and in this case, of course, the grain is being hauled, well, we like to say to Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
I might say, incidentally, that this project is funded in large part by the Patterson Foundation. This is,
yeah, I read that.
Out of Patterson steamships, of course, the shipping line, rather than the line elevators. I think the foundation is the guys in Thunder Bay, and they were sort of a sister operation, obviously, to the, with their cousins out here with the elevators. And was there any reaction in the community when Cargill built this throughput? Did people, there were those who belonged to the pool, Manitoba pool, I presume they were members. Were there participation dividends and so on and so forth?
Well,
or was there
Yes. Oh, I think there was, and rightfully so. Another concern that I had about Cargill was, you, with a standard elevator, you drive in on the scale, you weigh your truck. Now at Cargill, you dump the grain, and then it's weighed in the pit. So maybe I'm a little bit of a doubter sometimes. I says, how do I know whether there isn't a hole that drains it, type of thing? But
you're really dependent on the
integrity and the honesty of it. Yes,
of the company itself.
But personally, I've always had the opinion, if I don't trust the operator, that there's no point of arguing with him. It's better to change.
Go elsewhere.
But, and I think even with the traditional elevators, there was a change too. Before at the beginning, the way this the grain, and then it would write down on the ticket what the scale said. Well, now that had changed already. You would put in a piece of paper and it would punch it, so you would always get it accurate, because you could make a mistake of not writing on paper what necessarily was on the scale, type of thing.
Yes.
But the other thing is the marketing of your crop. That's another really dicey thing. When do you market, and what will the market do, which is really quite significant in farming, and to hit it right, type of thing.
Sure. And this is where farmers from 1935 on or so onwards depended on the wheat board to make those decisions, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Sort of consigned their crop to the wheat board and let the wheat board then. The system of advance payments, so you mentioned quotas early on in terms of how much a farmer could sell, so they distributed the selling over all the farmers. Advance payments came in at some point, I suppose. They weren't there from the beginning, or were they part of it?
Well, they came in, I forget what year, but I think it was in the 70s where they came in, you could take a certain percentage of your crop after you had harvested it, and you had it in storage, and then when you delivered, they would take I forget just what percentage, but it was way over half of it to get their payment back.
Sure.
Now, I think that was a good thing, because you couldn't move your grain, and you needed the money, and as input costs and that were increasing, the banker would like to see some money for his operating loan.
Right. Did the Diefenbaker government do some of that back in 57, 58? Do you remember anything of that?
Like advance?
Yes.
Well, maybe it was. Maybe I forgot the years. I better not be quoted. Maybe it was earlier than I thought.
It seems to be the 57 election involved some of that. I was sort of before my time a little bit. I was in high school at the time, but I remember.
Okay.
I know reading back the.
Well, that could well be, so
the
better not
the liberals had trusted the farmers, John said.
And
so the conservatives would trust the farmers in terms of how much they had. Concern of mine, too.
Okay.
But let me. Well, John, we've discussed so many of the various aspects of farming in quite specific terms. If I were to ask you what you would like people to know about the work that you did, and you know what might interest or surprise people most about what you did, would you have?
Well, like I said before, I was a small operator, mixed farming, but I think it's a kind of a toss-up. How aggressive do you want to be? And you have to risk a certain amount, but not risk too much. And I mentioned that earlier about the time when the bankers wouldn't borrow you much, wouldn't borrow you little but much. And I know a neighbor of mine who had three sons. They all wanted a farm, so they went that route. Well, it ended up now there's none of them farming. The fella, he still owns his original land and rents it out now, but none of his sons are farming, and I think that was a big mistake. So
pretty sad, really.
And there's another thing of caution that I would say, it's always a toss-up of buying new machinery and having capital cost allowance, or paying interest, or the other question, keeping the old and repairing it. And this is, I think, something very important that people really know where they're at in regard of debt. And the other side of it is with the volume that they have enough to keep their machinery in good shape. So that is one of the cautions I would like to pass on, that is very important.
Words of wisdom, really, from a lifelong farmer.
Well, you know, you can get too optimistic and get into deep, and I know this happened when the interest rates went to 22%. Different people lost their farms. And I think the other thing is, and I know speaking to the younger farmers now, if they don't get a bumper crop every year, they think it's kind of a disaster. Well, that's not true to life. We don't always get a bumper crop. And so I think you got to be cautious and also optimistic and keep that balance. That's very crucial.
That's a real challenge. The bankers were eager to loan a lot through the late 70s, I guess, was it, after the resource boom and the high prices the grain went to around 73, 74, would that be the period?
Yes, and even up to the early 80s.
When the interest rates went crazy.
They were still that way. All you heard was bigger is better, bigger is better. And sure, you can be too small, but you can also be too big and your efficiency drops quite a bit too. So there is a problem. And the other thing is, what do you want to live for? If that's all you want to live, to acquire an awful lot and leave to your family or whoever, one thing. Yeah. The other thing is, and there are many that do contribute to the community. I myself spent 19 years on the school board, which I do not regret, but to give you a broader outlook of the whole life of a rural area.
Yeah, it certainly does. I stepped over to the school to photograph the sign there, the contributors to the playground equipment. There's a real story to be written around all those names, company names, and then of course some individuals as well. That you could really give me footnotes on that particular picture, I have no doubt.
Well, they've had fundraising here for that special equipment, and they just put that up this summer, and
it looked that way.
And there's much more done for the public than the homes used to do a lot of that. Now it seems to have shifted to the educational system, and that is good in part. On the other hand, I think it maybe is not the best training all the time that they should get at the home.
But sure, well, I can understand that. What are you most proud of in the work that you've done over the years?
Well, humbly proud of.
Yes, we are Mennonites in origin, so we have to be proud of our humility, but
well,
of course. But
my life in the community, and actually what I'm most proud of is the time spent in on the school board before I became a member. And that was in the 60s when they were closing all the little schools in the area with the understanding that you come to Elm Creek and that'll be it. Well, that happened, and then they wanted to close the high school here. So I was on a committee we called Actions Committee, trying to preserve our high school here, which we had very good support from the community, and it still is operating, which we are thankful, although I did get a black name when I first came to the board meetings, and the first couple of times I opened my mouth, they shut me down because I was that bad guy from Elm Creek. And sometime later, and I was really kind of confused at the board meeting. They... partner I would go home with, I says, what was this about? Well, I don't know. Well, I says, how come everybody voted for it? I don't know. So I started asking questions. So this one day the chairman says, well, John, keep on asking questions and we all learn. So I was the scapegoat to plead my ignorance, but we all benefited. And actually it turned out very good. They say it's a thankless job. Well, I can't say that. When I quit after 13 years on the Midland board, and I had been 6 years on the Consolidated School Board in Wingham, the community had a appreciation afternoon, and that was really quite moving.
Yeah.
So I'm proud to have been part of the community. Another thing I'm quite proud of in our town, we have a senior home, and it's on the site where the first Consolidated School of Elm Creek was.
Yeah.
I was on the board at that time when the changeover came, and we bought the school site with the condition that within a couple of years we would have a senior home there, which turned out very well. Again, the public was very supportive, and a certain amount we had to put up ourselves. It's supported by the government, and it has been operating now since 1986. I was involved with it from the beginning right up to 2006, and then I thought, well, maybe it's better to quit before they tell him we don't want that old fella around anymore. But it's still operating very well. Yes. And now they have congregate meals there 5 days a week, so it's really served our community well and has kept our seniors in the community. So
sure.
Those two things I'm quite happy with.
Are some of the residents in this home old farmers too? Or?
Yes, there are some residents were farmers. There's a number of widows whose husbands were farmers. We have a fellow who was a businessman, Mr. Orr Hardware.
Oh, sure.
He lives in there. So it has served the community very well.
So Fraser Orr is still alive?
Yeah, he's still living. He's in that home. His wife isn't very well, but...
Yeah, you tell him hi from ABEP's son next time you see him. The only prize Dad ever won, I think, was a lamp he won at Orr's Hardware once
upon a time
back in the 50s.
Yeah, actually... they'll probably be sitting at the table. They have a meal at noon type of thing.
And
him and his wife usually are there.
Well. Well, John, there are questions about changes and challenges. I don't know whether you'd want to. I suspect we have been through most of that.
Yeah.
Things you might say.
Well, I think the biggest challenge is, one of the biggest ones is the marketing. And I think that's a very crucial thing with the wheat board. That was more or less a settled issue.
Yes.
Personally, of the wheat board,
a more settled issue, less reason to be anxious.
One of my points regarding the wheat board was I often thought if the agents that were selling the grain, if they were on a commission basis rather than on a salary, whether that would have worked a little better.
Made them hungrier, perhaps.
Well, I don't know. But, and I think the other thing maybe in this area, I feel not to get too big, because the bigger the farmers get, the fewer people we have, the fewer students we have. So it all reflects in that way too.
Yes.
So you got to be a certain size, but not not too big.
Having driven out as far as Deloraine on Tuesday and then back to Winnipeg on Wednesday, of course, I was thinking of the fact that from Winnipeg out to Elm Creek and Carmen, and the towns are 5 miles or a little bit more on along Highway 3. But when you get further west, boy, those towns are far apart out there. And the services are, of course, here too, Fannisdale and Kilderos. Starbuck, they have a limited amount of activity in them these days. But
Yes, that is another challenge regarding the implement dealers. They're farther away,
yes, I do,
and fewer. So, and all those things, and the grain industry too, it pays to shop.
I suppose.
It's not necessarily your local one is always giving you the best deal.
Right.
And you notice that with different grains, people go different places. So
sure.
That's something, you got to be a real good businessman to operate now as well as just brawn.
The industry has changed immensely over the 50, let's use 50 years or 60 from the middle of the 20th century. It's transportation, whatnot. There's so many changes that I can well imagine. I noticed in your front yard that you're a John Deere man. Is this through and through? And with whom would you deal there? Ince Brothers at Oak Bluff, the people you would deal with, or were there John Deere dealers closer to
Well, Carmen has a John Deere dealer, but like Ince Brothers too, they own it in Portage, and they own it, I think, in Morris. So, you know, there's...
And their Power Sports on the north side of the city, I think, or northeast. We came in from Beausejour, and
I
saw Ince Brothers Power Sports on Highway 59, I guess. Big operators.
The competition is less, I think, between the different agents. So you, with whatever trade you're dealing with or brand, it pays to shop around.
Sure.
But there is good service now and really good equipment. So it is really a pleasure to work with.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that too. Well, I think, John, we've spent almost an hour and three quarters at it. You've done a great job of telling me about the farming, and it's been great. So thank you very much. I think we'll push the button here that's required to stop, and I think that's it.
Well,